Since years before September 11th, we have heard news reports of the United States' interest in the energy resources present in the countries surrounding the Caspian Sea. In this program, we will explore how military occupation in Afghanistan is facilitating the U.S. development of the Central Asian energy market, involving such countries as Uzbekistan, Turkmenistan, Azerbaijan, Pakistan, and Afghanistan.
According to a front-page article in the Washington Post, November 18, the CIA has been mounting paramilitary operations in southern Afghanistan since 1997.
The hidden stakes in the war against terrorism can be summed up in a single word: oil. The map of terrorist sanctuaries and targets in the Middle East and Central Asia is also, to an extraordinary degree, a map of the world's principal energy sources in the 21st century. It is inevitable that the war against terrorism will be seen by many as a war on behalf of America's Chevron, Exxon, and Arco, France's Total, Tina Elf, British Petroleum, Royal Dutch Shell, and other multinational giants, which have hundreds of billions of dollars of investments in the region. Frank Viviano, San Francisco Chronicle, September 26, 2001.
The British-based Jane's International Security reported March 15, 2001, that the new American administration was working with India, Iran, and Russia, quote, in a concerted front against Afghanistan's Taliban regime.
Central Asia has enormous quantities of undeveloped oil resources, including 6.6 trillion cubic meters of natural gas and 10 billion barrels of undeveloped oil reserves. James Dorian, Oil and Gas Journal, September 10, 2001.
The December 15th New York Times Business Section reports, as the war shifts alliances, oil deals follow. The State Department is exploring the potential for post-Taliban energy projects in the region, which has more than 6% of the world's proven oil reserves and almost 40% of its gas reserves.
For the last 18 months, the CIA has been working with tribes and warlords in southern Afghanistan, and the division's units have helped create a significant new network in the region of the Taliban's greatest strength. Bob Woodward, Washington Post.
University of Illinois law professor Francis Boyle speaks about the United States' motivations for military occupation in Central Asia during his lecture last October at the Illinois Disciples Foundation.
What's really going on here? Why are we bombing Afghanistan? Why are we doing this? You know, is it retaliation? Is it vengeance? Is it some bloodlust? No, it isn't. The people who run this country are cold, calculating people. They know exactly what they're doing and why they're doing it. And during the course now, since the bombing started, it's become very clear what the agenda is. Secretary of Defense Rumsfeld flew to Uzbekistan and concluded an agreement with the dictator who runs that country, accused of massive violations of human rights, that the United States government will protect Uzbekistan. The Pentagon is now in the process of establishing a military base in Uzbekistan. It's been in the works for quite some time. They admit, yes, special forces have been over there for several years, training their people. We are making a long-term military arrangement with Uzbekistan. Why do we want to get in Uzbekistan? Very simple. The oil and natural gas resources of Central Asia, reported to be the second largest in the world after the Persian Gulf. And there has been an enormous amount of coverage of this in the pages of the Wall Street Journal, not the Newspeak Times. The movers and shakers, they've paid enormous attention to Central Asia and the oil resources there. Indeed, shortly after the collapse of the Soviet Union and the ascent to independence of these states in 1991, you saw all sorts of articles in the Wall Street Journal about how Central Asia and our presence in Central Asia has become a vital national security interest of the United States. And we proceeded to establish relations with these states of Central Asia. We sent over special forces. We're even parachuting the 82nd Airborne into Kazakhstan. All reported in the Wall Street Journal.
Peter Dale Scott, a professor at the University of Berkeley in California, gives more insight about the corporate involvement in the Central Asian oil market.
Everybody who's interested in oil is interested in Central Asia. There are huge oil reserves and gas reserves there, as also further west in Azerbaijan. This is the huge new area for oil and gas development. There were some Americans who very much wanted an agreement to recognize the Taliban, and the most prominent of these was the oil company, used to be called Union Oil of California, now we call it Unocal. And they were already involved with the government of Turkmenistan in oil and gas production there, and they very much wanted a pipeline that would bring one to bring gas and one to bring oil out of Turkmenistan down into Pakistan. And when Benazir Bhutto was still the prime minister of Pakistan, she thought, too, this would solve a lot of Pakistan's problems. It would beef up their economy, give them oil supplies that they needed, and be a sort of precedent for Pakistan being a gateway to Central Asia, which is going to be a huge new market as the oil and gas of this very petroleum-rich region is developed.
Provides another explanation of what it will take to tap the rich resources that are being marketed in Central Asia.
Since Central Asia is landlocked, you have to get the oil and natural gas out. How do you do that? Well, one way is to send it west, but we wish to avoid Iran and Russia. Highly circuitous route costs a lot of money. Very insecure. The easiest way to do it, construct pipelines south through Afghanistan into Pakistan and right out to the Arabian Sea. And Unocal was negotiating to do this with the government of Afghanistan. That's all in the public record.
In 1996, a Unocal-led consortium won a contract to build a 1,005-mile oil pipeline and a companion 918-mile natural gas pipeline, in addition to a tanker loading terminal in Pakistan's Arabian seaport of Gwandan. Annual projected income of the project was $2 billion, which in 5 years would have paid for its costs. The U.S. government and Unocal consortium feared that they could not build a pipeline as long as Afghanistan, which had been battered by war since the Soviet withdrew in 1989, was unstable. In 1998, Unocal shelved the project just after the U.S. missile crew strike against bin Laden's Afghan camps.
The 1991 collapse of the Soviet Union set off a mad scramble by U.S. energy companies and others to win concessions from the newly independent Central Asian states. It wasn't until 1995 to 1996, however, that the National Security Council, that key advisory group to the president, became the main architect of a policy to construct multiple oil and gas pipelines linking the Caucasus and Central Asia to global markets. Lines that would bypass Iran and break Russia's monopoly on existing routes. That's Alan Ruff, No War Times, January 2002.
Afghanistan's significance from an energy standpoint stems from its geographic position as a potential transit route for oil and natural gas exports from Central Asia to the Arabian Sea. This potential includes proposed multi-billion dollar oil and gas export pipelines through Afghanistan. U.S. Government Energy Information Fact Sheet in September 2000.
As one Russian newspaper described it, Russia's worries are not hard to understand. They have to do with post-war arrangements in Afghanistan. Economic interests are paramount. Turkmenistan and Uzbekistan need stability in Afghanistan so that they can transmit their oil and gas independently. James Ridgway, The Village Voice, October 2001.
The shortwave radio news service, Voice of Russia, confirmed last November 30th that negotiations over the pipelines in the Caspian Sea area are underway.
The U.S. Energy Secretary Spencer Abraham, now on a four-day visit to Russia, will participate in a ceremony to open a new oil pipeline from Kazakhstan to the Black Sea port of Novorossiysk on Tuesday. The program of the visit includes talks with his colleagues in Moscow, meetings with IMF leaders, and a visit to the Kurchatov Research Center. The opening of a new pipeline symbolizes the expansion of international cooperation in an area none of the countries can live without. The 1,500-kilometer pipeline, with a capacity of more than 32 million tons a year, will transport oil from the Tengiz deposit in the west of Kazakhstan, to a Black Sea terminal not far from the Russian port of Novorossiysk. The pipeline was built by the Caspian Pipeline Consortium. The participants in the consortium are 8 companies from 6 countries, including Russia, Kazakhstan, and Oman. Among the companies are Russian Lukoil, the American Chevron, Texaco, and ExxonMobil. For Russia and the United States, this is a giant project, a clear instance of fruitful and mutually beneficial trade contacts. According to the U.S. Energy Department, the construction of the pipeline made it possible to invest $2.5 billion in the Russian economy. The American minister's participation in the opening ceremony indicates that both nations are determined to expand trade and investment. This becomes clear from a joint statement adopted by the Russian and U.S. presidents in Washington earlier this month. In the statement, which focuses on Russian-American relations in the economic sphere, Vladimir Putin and George Bush welcomed the progress the two countries had reached in strengthening economic ties. Among other bilateral projects, the two presidents mentioned the oil pipeline of the Caspian Pipeline Consortium. Vladimir Putin and George Bush expressed support for other Russian-American investment projects.
Although Voice of Russia reports collaboration between the U.S. and Russia on the development of the pipelines, other sources claim the U.S. is competing with Russia and China for control over the area. Peter Dale Scott reports.
China is going to be an oil-hungry country fairly soon as it continues to increase at, 7% a year or something like that. Obviously, their oil consumption is going to go up beyond what I think they can get domestically. And Russia is also competing in the opposite direction. There is a certain amount of tension between Russia and America here about the future of Afghanistan. because quite clearly in 1996, not only UNICAL, but the State Department were hoping that if you could punch some pipelines through Afghanistan from Central Asia, specifically Turkmenistan, out to Pakistan, then that Central Asian oil and gas would begin to flow into the OPEC market. It would be shipped in tankers out of the Persian Gulf the way OPEC oil is. Russia, conversely, wants very much, up to now, it's had the privilege that the only pipelines going into Central Asia flowed north into Russia. Russia wants to keep it that way.
Because of the instability in the Persian Gulf, Cheney and his fellow oilmen have zeroed in on the world's other major source of oil, the Caspian Sea. Its rich oil and gas resources are estimated to be worth $4 trillion U.S. dollars by U.S. News & World Report. The Washington-based American Petroleum Institute, a voice of the major U.S. oil companies, called the Caspian region the area of greatest resource potential outside of the Middle East. Marjorie Cohn, Chicago Tribune, August 2000.
Those who control their oil routes out of Central Asia will impact all future direction and quantities of flow and the distribution of revenues from new production. James Dorian in Oil and Gas Journal on September 10, 2001.
The New York Times noted that during a visit in early December to Kazakhstan, Secretary of State Colin Powell said he was particularly impressed with the money that American oil companies were investing there. He estimated that $200 billion could flow into Kazakhstan during the next 5 to 10 years.
Azerbaijan, Kazakhstan, and Turkmenistan alone sat on the largest known reserves of unexploited energy. Control of these resources for the U.S. represented an opportunity to break free from a dependence on the Middle East, the recent site of two major wars and numerous brush fire conflicts, which rendered it susceptible to internal social instability and ongoing disputes. U.S. planners turned their sights to the new region in hopes of controlling these future reserves. Alan Ruff, No War Times, January 2002.
As the Bush administration ventures to the far reaches of the earth to win over more oil, a pertinent question is raised. What is our domestic energy policy that perpetuates the dynamic of war for oil? In this report from the High Plains News Service, Hunter Lovins of the Rocky Mountain Institute gives a critique of Bush's energy policy and also gives examples of alternative means of providing energy.
The single most vulnerable part of our energy system isn't a particular piece of infrastructure, it's the system itself. She and co-author Amory Lovins argue that the system is too complex, interdependent, and reliant on large centralized sources of energy. They say America would be better served by a system that emphasizes what they call resilience.
Think about a tree. A tree doesn't get its power from one big leaf hanging out there in the sun. If that one leaf got blown away, the tree would be in trouble. Similarly, there are lots of branches and veins. The tree can get its power from anywhere around the tree. If half the tree gets blown away or broken off, the tree can still survive. That's a dispersed, diverse, distributed energy system. And those are some of the qualities that make up resilience.
The Lovinses say that over the last 20 years, the resilience of America's energy system has improved somewhat because very few new, large, centralized power plants have been built. They say the country has met its increasing energy needs through smaller power projects, growth in renewables, and gains in efficiency. Hunter Lovins is worried, however, that President Bush's National Energy Plan threatens this resilience.
The current Bush plan will dramatically reduce our energy security. Disproportionately, well over 90% of the money that it intends to spend would go to conventional sources of energy, large nuclear plants, coal plants, drilling in Alaska, the kinds of things that simply cannot increase our energy security. Only a tiny amount of the money, and in fact the exact amount of money that had already been budgeted, would be going to efficiency and renewables. No additional money. So, no, it's spherically senseless. It makes no sense no matter which way around you look at it.
Mike Davenport of Wisconsin Renew offers advice about how to reduce our dependency on petroleum a historical motivation for military intervention. In this interview, Davenport also points out that fossil fuel is the foundation of a global society.
So as far as reducing our dependency on energy sources on the other side of the world, you would say that the way to do that would be by consuming less?
In general, yes. I'd say that because we live on a finite planet, we know that we cannot accelerate the process by which vegetable matter turned into oil. That takes tens of millions of years for decaying organic matter to turn into oil, and only under certain conditions does that happen. So, in other words, we can't invent a concentrated energy source like oil. So what's the next best step is just to use less of this resource that we're depleting rapidly. And so doing, we give ourselves a little more time, a little bigger cushion to shift to an alternative set of resources to the extent that they can actually, to the extent they can play a positive or constructive role, and also just to shift to a somewhat different economy that is less dependent on energy sources for global travel. I think we're going to have to move towards a more localized set of economies. Globalization I think in 30 or 40 years from now, we'll recognize globalization as a historical trend that was underwritten by cheap fossil fuel. You take cheap fossil fuel out of the equation, and globalization doesn't pack anywhere near the same economic rationale.
So what do you think society would look like without that global model?
A little closer to what society looked like 100 years ago. With local regional producers and businesses and people that purchase the goods, I think you'll see agriculture become less of a commodity industry, and more attuned to the demands of the local markets they are serving, or it is these products are supplying. Kind of a slowing down also of our travel and mobility. That is to say that less likely to fly, less likely to travel across the country. I see all that as inevitable. But the important question to policymakers is when does this global economy reach the peak? The maximum amount of recoverable oil at any one time. And if you go past that peak point in history, then it doesn't really matter how much money is spent in exploration and drilling activity. What comes up is less than what was pulled up the year before.
We're all actors in this, I suppose. What has happened is that in the last 20 years, America has changed from a producer to a consumer. And all consumers know that when the producer names a tune, the consumer has got to dance. The way it is. We used to be a producer, very inflexible at that, and now we are consumers and finding it difficult to understand. Natural resources and minerals will change your world. The Arabs used to be in the third world. They have bought the second world and put a firm down payment on the first one. Controlling your resources will control your world.
This country, we should not be spending a lot of time about, you know, who did what to whom on September 11th. We need to be focusing on this war, on stopping this war. We need to be focusing on stopping the humanitarian tragedy against the people, the millions of people of Afghanistan right now today. And third, we need to be focusing on what could very easily become a regional war.
You can chase down all your enemies, try to bring them to their knees. You can bomb the world to pieces, but you can't bomb it into peace. Well, you may even find solutions to hunger and disease. You can bomb the world to pieces, but you can't bomb it into peace. The earthquake of hatred simply brings more of the same. Military madness, the smell of flesh and burning pain. So I cry out to the people then, stand up if you're still sane. To all of us gone crazy, I sing this one refrain. Well, you can chase down all your enemies, try to bring them to their knees. Can bomb the world to pieces, but you can't bomb it into peace. Well, you may even find solutions to hunger and disease. You can bomb the world to pieces, but you can't bomb it into peace. I say power to the people, and yes, I say power to the people, man.